A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on January 13, 1991, entitled God's Glory in Cracked Pots. The scripture reading is 2 Corinthians 4, verses 1 through 12 and 16 through 18. The text for the sermon is 2 Corinthians 4, verse 7. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
I'm going to take a risk and let you know how I got here. Not the roads I traveled, but the way I traveled this week and finally until this morning in order to get to this point of preaching to you this morning. It's always a rather circuitous way and a perilous way, but sometimes it's better than others, and sometimes it's simply awful. And that's the way it was for me this week, and as the time came closer and closer to having to stand up or sit down and say something. I suppose that I'm not so different from most of us, hoping that the world situation, the crisis would go away. Not really wanting to believe that we could get down to this point of deadline and potential disaster with the ravages of war unleashed upon our world. And yet finally, I think we are soberly aware that that has a very real possibility in the days and the weeks that lie before us. And so, throughout this season of Advent and Christmastide and Epiphany, I have been aware of the contrast with that which we experienced just a year ago. It was so much fun then. It seemed like there was the possibility of a whole new world and a whole new world order. And it was so exhilarating to be able to read the vision of the peaceable kingdom from the prophet and to speak of the Prince of Peace and to see the signs of shalom in the unraveling of the drama of history right before our eyes. I think if we went back and monitored the tapes of those services, those messages, we would find that we weren't Pollyanna, we didn't stick our head in the sand as though every day in every way the world was getting better and better and that now everything was going to be just fine. Nonetheless, there were signs of shalom, and we claimed them, and we rejoiced in them, and I think rightly so. But it's been a different season this year, and I don't know if that has anything to do with the fact that this has been a particularly difficult season for me to get my preaching together. I generally try to get the whole season together, and at a time like this, I'd do Advent and Christmas and probably Epiphany until I could get on vacation and plop. But I couldn't do it this year for some reason. And I was working a week or two ahead of time, which I don't like at all. But as the season progressed, I was becoming aware of something. Something working in me, something calling me back to it over and over again. The concreteness of God in our history. You say, well, big whoop. That's what Christmas is all about. You talk about that every year. Emmanuel, the child's name, God with us. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. So what do you mean, the concreteness of God in our human experience? Well, I think the advantage of the Christian year is that cycling through that year after year after year, we are just liable to get some new slant or some new angle or some deeper insight into that which is so familiar. The disadvantage, of course, is that it can become so familiar that we miss that which is so plain and its impact fails to register with us. But I was beginning to sense, I think as never before, what it meant that God was with us, that the Word became enfleshed in our history, indeed in our flesh. The reality of God here and now in the messiness and the muck and the mire of history. And so this week, with the situation of the world being what it is, I began to reflect backward. Generally, I set series for preaching in advance. But today I want to announce a series in retrospect. The Sunday before Christmas, wishful thinking, the vision of the kingdom, the question whether or not it was just wishful thinking, the refusal to look history in the eye, the longing, the nostalgic longing for the serene Judean hills with shepherds and wise men on camels and a baby in the manger. We came to see that that's not at all the way it was. It was the world of Caesar Augustus. It was the world of Roman legions. It was the world of a coercive census and taxes and population manipulation. It was a brutal and cruel world. And the coming of the light into the world was not a denial of the darkness, but the announcement of the light in the darkness. But it's a scary world, and we acknowledged that the next week. I'm afraid that. Tripping off our lips over and over again, not in the presence of some imminent crisis or danger, but the way we live, fearfully. But we heard the Word of God that there is no room for fear in love, and that perfect love casts out fear, and that in this the love of God is disclosed, in that God sent God's Son into the world, and that the one who dwells in God dwells in love, and the one who dwells in love dwells in God. God is love. And the love of God became enfleshed in Jesus. And so over and over and over again we heard that word. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, Zacharias. Fear not, Mary. Fear not, Joseph, to embrace the flesh of Mary. Don't be afraid. God with us. God here and now. God in the ambiguity of our human situation. And that's where we were last week. To be sure, the Magi saw the star in the sky, but it might have been some other heavenly phenomena. They followed the star. They took a risk. We heard that old Latin motto, seize the day. Live now, here and now, so live that if at the end of one's life there's nothing more, one will have lived well. Thoreau said, I went out to the wood in order that I might live intentionally and deliberately, that I might suck all of the marrow out of life, that I might not come to my point of death and discover that I had never lived. Epiphany, a world awash with God. This world, awash with God. Our world, with all of its ambiguity, with all of its lack of clarity, its ambiguity in nature, a star, a sign, or just another star, a child, a special child or something more. The cross, sign of God's love or of the depth of human darkness, ambiguity, having to hear the word, trust the word, act on the word, and only in retrospect being able to say, God spoke to me, God here and now. Well, epiphany, God manifests, light in our darkness. And so for the day, the text, or the context at least, marvelous statement of Paul, probably never said any more concisely, the God who said, let light shine out of darkness, in other words, the only God there is, the God, the Creator, the one who upholds the world, in the palm of God's hand, that God who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shined into our hearts the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. There you have it. The concreteness of the revelation in the flesh of Jesus, Christmas, Epiphany. But the next verse, really my text, what really drew me is the fact that Paul says, and we have this treasure, this light, this glory, this knowledge, this sense, we have this in earthen vessels, clay pots. Doesn't really say crack pots. I said that. And it's true about 95% of the time. I mean, it's just folks like us. The light has dawned. The light shines. The light has found containers, and the containers are humankind, like us. Once again, drawn back to that concreteness of the presence and the grace and the light of God in the messiness, in the mire, and in the muck of history. Not some anesthetized, sanitized, celestial chamber somewhere, but in history, in your life and in mine, with all of its ambiguity and all of its pain and its celebration, in the stuff of ordinary lives, of ordinary folk like us, there, light. I thought, well, I suppose, having preached for 30 plus years, I ought to be able to do something with that text on Epiphany Sunday. But I couldn't. Because as the week got closer to 0 hour for me, the world news raised in its decibels, the crisis seemed to be more imminent. And I was haunted by a story I heard from Bruce Tielicki, who is the preacher at First Presbyterian Church in Pittsburgh, which is one of the great pulpits of the country, which has had some of the great pulpiteers of the country, one of the greatest being Clarence McCartney. Bruce Tielicki preaches there now. He's a great preacher. He told me one day about scratching around in the attic of old First Pres Pittsburgh. And he came across a box of old sermons of Clarence McCartney. And preachers always look for other sermons by other preachers. We've been into this business of recycling for a long time. And he happened to pick up a sermon dated December 14, 1941. Does that mean anything to you? You know where you were on December 7th? You were in church, of course. Those of you that were old enough to remember, because it was a Sunday. December 14 was the next Sunday. And Bruce Tielicki said to me, I read through the sermon And from reading that sermon, I would have not known that there was anything going on in the world. I was given no clue from reading that sermon that the world had been plunged into the convulsions of world conflict and conflagration. And that story haunted me all yesterday and all last night. And I thought, you know, I can't come here and talk about Epiphany and the light of the revelation of God in the face of Jesus Christ and sing our hymns and say our prayers and go out of here as though nothing's happening in the world. If that's true, if I could do that, then what we're doing here is just playing games and it doesn't have any relevance and then it doesn't meet us where we're living. Then we are denying the very thing we have just celebrated, that is that the Word became flesh. And that incarnation means here and now in the mire and muck and messiness of the human situation. So, 10:30 last night and no sermon. I mean, it's one thing to determine that one has to say something. It's another thing to know what to say. I don't know what to say. I'm confused. That's what I'll tell you. Preacher's supposed to have answers. This preacher's got questions. And I tell you that and I share that with you because I suspect you do too. We're going to pray. We're going to pray for peace. But we don't know how that's going to come. And I'm not sure how it ought to come. I think about a lot of things. In fact, have you got an hour? I'm drawn to that consistent position of pacifism. Jesus faced the powers, faced the darkness, unflinching, said to Peter, "Put up your sword." That was not weakness. That was the greatest strength the world has ever seen. And he received the blow in his own body, and on the cross as he was dying, he said, "Father, forgive them." There was no hostility. He had been consistent to the end. I wish I had that kind of strength. And I hope there will always be those among us who will live that out consistently, reminding us that the only way power and darkness will be dismantled is through a more powerful demonstration of love and grace. But I'm not ready to advocate that to George Bush, to be honest with you. It's not so easy to move 2,000 years across time from a Nazarene who was a member of a subject people in the face of mighty Rome to be a nation the most powerful in the world, at its best committed to freedom and the dignity of the human person. What do we do? Gandhi practiced passive resistance in a most impressive way. Did you see the film? Did you see where the peasants presented themselves and the English guns began to mow them down? And eventually the guns were stilled because behind English guns there were English people who have been conditioned over centuries by the gospel of Jesus Christ, who could not just mow down people standing there defenseless. I'm not sure what Hussein's order would be if we lined up on the borders of Kuwait and presented our bodies. There's another conception of reality operating there. I was talking about all of these world religion questions one time with my dear Professor Berkoff, who said to me, "Don't forget the Christian faith conquered by the cross, which is the way of crucifixion and servanthood. Islam conquered and swept the world by the sword and conquest." It's a different conception of reality, and I have to acknowledge that. And beyond that, quite apart from the Christian-Islamic question, there is the whole question of the individual, the one who holds power, where there are all sorts of things operating. Power, prestige, world conquest, visions of grandeur, all of that's operating. I'm not ready to say to George Bush, "Follow Jesus on this one." Should we go to war? We should not go to war for oil. Our way of life has demanded that we be there for oil. Let those who fault the president for getting us there ask themselves honestly if they are willing to give up a way of life, a whole way of life. And we've all bought into it and we're all implicated in it. I'm not sure that we didn't have to go there. But will we go to war? Not for oil. God help us. Seems to me the only way we dare go to war is if we have searched our minds and hearts and have determined that it is the only way to stop naked aggression in this world of ours. And then if we conclude that, let us acknowledge that we have not been even-handed in our response to aggression in the world. It has depended altogether on its implications for us. Let's be honest about that. Let us all also acknowledge that our president is not telling the truth when he says there is nothing to link Kuwait and the Palestinian problem. There certainly is. The linkage goes back decades, and even beyond that to ancient feuds. We have not been even-handed. We have played our cards for the well-being, the national security of this, our nation. And we ought to be honest and acknowledge that the Middle East will continue to fester and be potentially the powder keg of the world until those injustices are acknowledged and are dealt with. And then, of course, there are voices that say, even so, we ought to give sanctions more time, more negotiation. And I sense that there are honest people, clear-thinking people, decent people on both sides of that issue. And I don't know. But George Bush has to know. Because finally, one has to act. And one has to act as a human being with limited insight, with partial knowledge, and with an inability to see totally the implications of one's action. And you say, why? Why? Why is it so difficult? Why is it so impossible to know these things? Why does one always have to act without being able to predict the full scenario, without having all the information? Why is every action so overlaid with all kinds of personal agenda and national agenda and ancient wounds? Nothing is simple, nothing is clear. God says, that's right. That's where you are. The light has dawned upon us, dear friends. It has dawned in the darkness of our human existence. Right in the mire and the muck and the messiness of the human situation. Oh, we'd love to come to church and have it be different. We'd love to come to church and have somebody give us a simple answer. And to arouse our wrath and energize us so we can march off triumphalistically knowing you won't get it here. You won't get it from me. But you will get this. My deep conviction that the light has dawned upon us and that the light that shines in our darkness, the darkness will never overcome. And that whether it be in the personal agenda of your life, in the dark winter of the soul, or whether it be the darkness of the world in its present crisis, we will not be abandoned. We are called to act according to our best wisdom and insight before the face of God, knowing that we are accountable to God, and knowing that however we act, we'll never be forsaken by God. We are not alone. God is with us. The God who in the beginning said, let light shine out of darkness. Who hung a star in space to call some Iraqi magi to go a great distance to bow before a Jewish child whom the Gentiles have found to be the Savior of the world. God's glory in the likes of us. The likes of us. God help us.